Good afternoon, members of the court. My name is Victor Boog, spelled B-O-O-G, attorney number 2561, appearing on behalf of Interstate Transportation, Inc., otherwise known as ITI. This case has caused, I think, both counsel on appeal to reflect on how it began, and as much as during the course of this appeal, there was a request to supplement the record, and that was denied because evidence not presented to the district court may not be considered on review, and so that's how we got here. As you all know, having read the briefs, this case was filed by ITI against Mr. Cudahy and a wholly owned company of his called Specialized Motors. It was a case in which opposing counsel moved for a dismissal under Rule 12b-5, not because it failed to state a claim, the complaint in this case, but because he felt it was precluded either by res judicata, including issue preclusion or claim preclusion, in essence. The trial court, because there was no claim that it failed to state a claim, the complaint, I jumped right into the issue on the merits, thinking that on the merits of this case, it is not precluded by res judicata, claim preclusion, issue preclusion. And I did that because both counsel recognized that Judge Berryhill, the trial court judge, had tried the earlier case not that long before this case was filed. And he had obviously knowledge of the pleadings in the case as well as his rulings in the case and perhaps some memory of the testimony in the case. And from my vantage point, I assumed that he was going to take judicial notice of some of the things that had happened in the case that the judicial notice would permit. I also assumed that he would be ruling on this not as a matter of 12b-5, but as a matter of summary judgment because of considering matters outside the scope of the pleading, the complaint itself.
Counsel, let me just interrupt you briefly. In your response, though, your opposition to the motion, you didn't ask him to take judicial notice, nor did you ask him to convert it into a motion for summary judgment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So have you waived those issues now?
I wanted this at the trial court level to be decided on the merits because I thought on the merits we should win. And I'm here today saying that on the merits we should win.
Let me explore that a little bit. I believe you were the one in our court who asked to supplement the record with the record from the first trial.
I did.
I believe that was unopposed, and it was denied for the reason that you said. What would be your position, and I'm going to ask counsel for appellee the same question, what if we reversed that and did that now? What would you think about that?
It wouldn't offend me at all because the last thing I want to do is have this case sent back to the trial judge because the record wasn't complete. Mainly because, number one, opposing counsel never sought to introduce formal matters of the record any more than I did. So in hindsight, we both were somewhat remiss in that regard, assuming that because this judge had seen all these things, there was sufficient things in the pleadings themselves and his ruling that could answer the question for him without getting into the details of the testimony and the exhibits. So would I object to that? No. Because if, in fact, this were sent back for a procedural defect, I think we'd be back here on the merits at a later date. And I'm hoping that I'm not going to get washed out of court because of procedural defect and not get a hearing on the merits at all.
Thank you. It's helpful.
If we were to supplement, I think we would need additional briefing because unless you expect us to paw through the record and figure out what's relevant and what isn't.
Given the court's disposition of the earlier motion, I would certainly welcome the chance to do additional briefing so that the court would see the full panoply here of what happened in the earlier case. I'm not sure what opposing counsel would think about that.
We'll ask him.
Okay. Going to the merits of this case, because there was never any issue in the motion to dismiss that the complaint fails to state a claim, I didn't go there. Hindsight, maybe I should have, but I thought that on the merits of claim preclusion, it was obvious to me that in the earlier case, two individual stockholders, minority shareholders of ITI, brought a claim on their own behalf saying that distributions and dividends made by the company, which Mr. Cuddy controlled, were wrongfully, the distributions and the dividends themselves were okay. The company had the authority to do that. What we said was he took a lion's share and he wasn't entitled to it because he hadn't paid for a stock that would have given him a 67% of those dividends. That was the issue at trial. Did he pay for his stock as required by the stock purchase agreement? We thought we convinced this court with undisputed testimony that he had never paid for his stock in the form it was supposed to have been paid. That instead, he attributed all the monies he advanced to the company to a loan account with the company. And as a result of that loan account, he continued to pay himself interest and return of principal long after he'd have been able to do so had the money that he had submitted to the company been attributed to capital purchase of stock. There was no doubt about what Mr. Cuddy had done. He played at both ends. He had had an outside accountant, the CPA for the company, treat it as if he had paid $125,000 for stock. He had the inside accountant treat the books as if he had used that on his loan account. And he wrote himself checks on the loan account, far beyond what the loan account would have been had the money been attributed to his stock purchase.
How is that claim different from the claim you've made in this case?
In that case, the claim was made by two individuals who said, this isn't the company's money anymore. This dividend and distribution was made. It was our collective money, the three shareholders, and we didn't get our share of it because Cudahy wrote himself a check for the lion's share of it without authority.
We're talking about the same payments, but...
Oh, but we're not.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get a handle on.
The money that Mr. Cudahy paid himself in interest and consulting fees, which are the subject of this lawsuit, are not the same amounts as the monies he attributed to his stock purchase and that the company and the trial court found were attributed to the stock purchase. Example, the interest that he paid himself that we're after in this case was, I think, 16% on the first 50,000 of loans and 10% on the rest. And that interest really multiplied over years. In addition, when he could no longer even convince his outside accountant to allow himself to take interest and principal on loans that weren't there anymore because the outside accountant said you had to give that 125 to the stock purchase, he then paid himself consulting fees. These consulting fees and this interest in repayment of principal on a non-existent loan are not the same dollars in amount or at time of acquiring these assets from the company as the amounts he took as excess distributions that were rightfully my clients.
Couldn't those claims have been brought in the first action either by the company directly or as derivative claims by the two individual plaintiffs?
I suppose they could have been brought as derivative claims, but they weren't. Because
but doesn't claim preclusion preclude claims that could have been brought?
Not under the four elements that I know of that are briefed in this case. The elements are, did you have common claims? Did you have parties that were in privity, or if they're not the same parties, were they in privity? And were the parties, my clients, virtually representing the company in the first lawsuit? And the answer is absolutely not. Why not? Because they were claiming that the monies that should have been paid for stock were not paid. That's in direct contradiction to the claim now being made that, oh yes, those monies were paid for stock as the trial court found in the first case. But they were not. And so in the first case, we said, we got no problem with them taking interest on loans because that's what we think they were. They were loans. That's how he defined them and how he treated them. But in the early case, we'd have been juggerheads, or we'd have been absolutely opposed to the company saying these were loans, because we wanted the money in their pocket. And in this case, the money goes 67%. The irony is that in this case, if this gets reversed and goes back to trial, there's collateral estoppel here. Mr. Cudahy can no longer claim that these were proper interest payments and proper consulting fees. This company doesn't do anything. It's a shell, ITI. It has no consulting to perform. And that's a different claim in this case. There was no claim for consulting fees by my client in the first case. And there wouldn't have been any claim by my clients for consulting fees or bad interest or return of principal that he wasn't entitled to, because they were acknowledging his election to treat his money as a loan to the company for which he was entitled to get interest and return of principal.
I'm trying to figure out, Mr. Cuddy is still the majority shareholder in the company?
Under our theory, which we have lost, he'd have been majority by having about 50.1%.
But you lost it, and he's got like
67%.
So if he's the majority owner, how's the company bringing the lawsuit here?
Ah, because this company is an Indiana corporation, and under Indiana law, the board of directors dictates what actions the company takes, not the majority shareholder. The other thing was that at the underlying trial in the earlier case, Mr. Cudahy at that point in time had thrown my clients off the board of directors. And in a subsequent ruling, the trial judge found that he wasn't entitled to do that. That was subject to a separate appeal in this court and is still pending on appeal with respect to that issue. But in that earlier trial case, the trial court found that my clients were, in fact, entitled to be on the board, and Mr. Cuddy wasn't entitled to put his wife and son on the board and throw my clients off. And so now my clients are two out of the three members when this case was brought, and they had the right to bring it on behalf of the company. Now, it's true that given the underlying case, Mr. Cuddy is going to get 67% of the spoils if there is a case that proceeds and if he has to pay the bill. Whereas if we had won in the earlier case, we'd have gotten 49% of those monies or been entitled to it subject to creditors' claims and so forth. I'd like to reserve the last 2 minutes or so for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Boog. You've got about 2 minutes and 22 seconds.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Ted Rosen. I represent the appellees in the case, Edward Cudahy and Specialized Motorsports, and my bar registration is 18098. I'd like to make a couple of observations in light of Mr. Boog's remarks. There is a companion case that was on appeal, and another panel actually issued its order about a month ago in that case. One of the issues on appeal was whether Mr. Cudahy was entitled to replace the two minority shareholders, Mr. Ingram and Mr. Egan, with his wife and his son, and also, in addition to that, whether he was entitled, by virtue of his majority ownership, to increase the number of directors from 3 to 5 and have the right to identify, to name who directors number 4 and number 5 would be, because that would effectively give him a 3-2 vote at the board level. The panel of this court addressing that found that Misters Ingram and Egan had a right to remain on the board as long as they desired and as long as they held their membership interests, but that Mr. Cudahy also had the right to increase the size of the board so that it became a 5-member board. The court remanded the case back to Judge Berryhill to determine whether Mr. Cudahy had the right to name who those directors 4 and 5 should be, or whether that would be subject to a board vote where 2 board members would be able to outvote the 1 board member. So that's kind of the scope of that issue on remand from the other panel. With respect to the court's question about potential reverse in the earlier decision on supplementing the record, I think that if the court were to do that, the court would end up in a position no different than it is today here, because Judge Berryhill's finding that he could take judicial notice of what occurred in the trial court that gave him a basis for entering the ruling that he did wouldn't be subject to being disturbed by this court unless the court, in reviewing the supplemental record, concluded in its own opinion that, no, the pleadings that were filed in what we've referred to as Cudahy 1 in the briefs weren't sufficient, Judge Berryhill, to give you the evidentiary basis to make the finding of judicial notice that you did.
Let me ask you about that, because you referred to Judge Berryhill's finding that he was taking judicial notice, but isn't that part of the problem? He never said that. Maybe he thought in his own mind he was doing it, but there was that record wasn't part of the record that we have here, and he never even used the words judicial notice.
I agree, but I don't think a trial judge needs to use those magic words to invoke judicial notice. And I say that because a trial court has the ability, sua sponte, meaning even if neither party has asked the court for dismissal, for the court to decide based upon what it's heard before that it's trapped in what I've called Groundhog Day before, that it's heard it before, and based upon its prior knowledge gained from its sitting earlier on the bench, it can go ahead and dismiss the second case based upon judicial notice.
Based solely on his memory without referring to any papers or evidence or testimony?
I hesitate to say yes to that because I looked for some case law on that point and didn't find any case law one way or the other. But my hunch, Your Honor, is that even if this court supplemented the record, this panel will find, you know, substantial evidence in the pleadings, etc. I don't know whether the court would get down to the level of looking through the actual exhibits that were introduced, but there will be plenty of evidence to support Judge Berryhill's, what I think his finding was, based upon what I'd seen before. I'm taking judicial notice of that.
So, hey, excuse me, Jeff.
So is your position that, just like Mr. Boog, if we decided to do that, to ask that that record be supplemented and perhaps then allow further briefing, you wouldn't have an objection to that?
I wouldn't have an objection. I don't think it's necessary for this panel to do that, but if the panel thought that it was, then I wouldn't have any objection to that. I'm not certain that there's additional briefing that would be required on it for the reasons that I mentioned.
So how do we determine whether there's any evidence to support Judge Berryhill's findings when there's no evidence in the record? For example, there's not even any evidence in the complaint does not even refer to Mr. Ingram or Mr. Egan. Doesn't refer to the other lawsuit, and yet you're saying we can decide this without the benefit of any such evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it may make this panel more comfortable to supplement the record and look at that evidence. So that's why I'm hesitant to answer that question yes to your previous question. I think that if the panel wanted to make sure that the pleadings filed in Cudahy 1 were such that Judge Berryhill properly took notice of it, then I would not object to that request.
Okay. And are you saying he took judicial notice of facts, but not necessarily of records? Is that your point? He just remembered what happened at the trial and related that, but he did not take judicial notice of a particular pleading or of any testimony.
I think that that's correct, Your Honor.
And in your understanding, that's when a judge takes judicial notice, it either has to be public knowledge, everybody knows is the case, or it has to be to a verifiable source, doesn't it?
Such as a court pleading.
And so, which we don't have before, so we can't decide whether his finding is supported by that.
Fair enough. So it might be of assistance to this panel to get the pleadings from Cudahy 1 or the record from Cudahy 1 that Mr. Boog and I had agreed would be part of this record in order to complete your review of it.
And wouldn't we need you and Mr. Boog to sort of hold our hands and show us where you think the judge's findings are supported by the record?
I think that would be helpful to the panel. Yes.
Thank you.
Let me also make an observation about the underlying litigation and how it interplays with what we called Cudahy 2. We tried the Cudahy 1 case over a three-day period in front of Judge Berryhill, and Judge Berryhill entered the order that he did. It wasn't until after that order, which was adverse to the appellants, was issued by Judge Berryhill, that we were served with this new complaint, which forms the basis of the Cudahy 2 case and the appeal today. And it's our position that all of the elements of claim preclusion are present in this case, that if you go through each of the four elements, it becomes manifestly clear that the facts that the appellants are complaining of not only could have been raised in Cudahy 1, but were raised in Cudahy 1. The only difference in Cudahy 2, really, is that they're being recast or repackaged. Since they lost the argument that the payments made by the company to my client were improper distribution, since my client hadn't paid for his full two-thirds ownership, they've now characterized those payments as something different than distributions, and now characterized them as either improper interest payments or improper consulting fees. And nowhere in the briefing that appellants have done have they argued that they were unaware of those facts and incapable of making whatever legal claims or asserting whatever legal claims they wanted to at the trial court level.
So, recognizing that we don't have the record in front of us, so we can't check it out, how do you respond to Mr. Boog's argument to us that we're talking about different transactions, different amounts, different monies coming at different times, and that these are not the same thing? Is that, I take it you don't agree with that?
That is correct, Your Honor, because they are arguing about the same money. It's just the label that they're affixing to the money that they claim now gives them a new independent basis for filing this second suit.
See, the problem that I think we have is that's certainly the thrust of what Judge Berryhill said in his claim preclusion order, but we have no way of knowing whether the record supports that finding or not because we don't have that record.
Understood. And let me carry on with that thought for a moment, because even if Mr. Boog was true in that regard, that still would not defeat the application of claim preclusion in this case, because claim preclusion applies not only to bar claims that were actually asserted, but claims that could have been asserted. And there is no argument in the briefs that the appellants have submitted that they were incapable of making the precise claims that they're making today at the Cudahy 1 trial.
Aren't they saying that they were ICE claims, therefore they couldn't assert them?
That they, if they are saying that, that is incorrect, because the same basis that allows them to proceed on Cudahy 2 today, that is derivatively, was available to them to proceed in Cudahy 1.
Not proceed.
I agree, but they certainly could have proceeded in Cudahy 1 on a derivative basis, which is a point that I think Judge Berryhill mentioned in his order.
Many times.
That's correct. So in terms of the application of the actual doctrine, each element is present. The one other issue I just wanted to address briefly is this privity issue and whether or not the appellants are in privity with Mr. Ingram and Mr. Egan, because the case law in Colorado, it's a little bit mixed, but there's one central fact that will tell us how the court will rule on the privity issue. If all of the members or shareholders of the corporation are present in the first case, all of the economic interests of the corporation and of those individual members is now kind of at issue in the first case. So if in the first case only members are involved in an individual capacity and two of the members lose against the third member, as happened here, and then those other two losing members try to assert a claim on behalf of the company, the courts are uniform in holding that there was privity between the two losing members in the first case and the corporation, because all of the economic interest in the corporation was present and had an opportunity to litigate their claims in the first case. And claim preclusion, Your Honors, doesn't mean that each member has a full right to present whatever type of evidence they want to in a case. It means that each member and the economic interest holder, if there's a corporation present, had a full and fair opportunity to litigate their claims, had a fair forum to go into and present their claims to a court. And that's precisely what happened here. So what we find ourselves, the situation we find ourselves now in, is we went through first lawsuit, everybody spent a lot of money defending against it and prosecuting it, we got our result, and the losing party didn't like their result, and they've tried to figure out a way to repackage it and have a second bite at the apple. That is precisely the scenario where claim preclusion should be applied to bar that from happening. So we would request that the court enter an order affirming Judge Berryhill in any event that the court decides it wants to have a supplementation of the record. We'll go ahead and brief that as the court tells us to do, but we're going to be back here, assuming that there's oral arguments, again, making the same type of request.
I ask you, with respect to the payments that were allegedly made to Specialized, could those have been asserted in the first action?
They could have, and the payments, and that deals with kind of a corollary issue. That's privity of defendants, in contrast to privity of the plaintiffs, where a defendant's actions, like Mr. Cudahy's, provide the basis for the alleged liability, and the other co-defendant's liability is premised solely upon, I hate to even use this word, derivative, because I don't want to get it confused, but there's no independent wrongdoing that the second co-defendant is alleged to have engaged in, then the defensive use of collateral estoppel and claim preclusion applies. So the fact that they tacked on one new defendant in this case doesn't make Cudahy 2 a different case for purposes of claim preclusion than Cudahy 1 was.
But the claim that a payment was made to Specialize, that was not actually litigated in the first case. Is that correct?
That is correct, because Specialized was not a party in Cudahy 1, is my recollection.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen.
Thank you.
Mr. Boo, you've got about 2 minutes and 22 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you. The four principal elements of claim preclusion are a little different from saying, well, could it have been litigated in the first case? The four elements say, one of them is the claim for relief the same? The claim for relief is not the same. This is the first claim was a claim for relief of two individuals as shareholders for their own pocketbook. And for future pocketbook, if it turned out that he only had 50.1% of the stock. The claim that's being made by ITI today is for the corporation's monies that Judge Berryhill's decision clearly confirmed he wasn't entitled to as interest and principal return. And it's another claim in this case as well by the corporation for consultant fees that he subsequently took without corporate approval by a board of directors or anybody else. Those claims were not in the first case, so there's no claim relationship. And this privity of parties, since the parties were different, requires that the parties that brought the first case were the virtual representative of the unnamed party, namely the corporation itself, and that they were fighting this battle on behalf of the corporation. Neither was true. They were fighting this battle for their own pocketbook and their own pocketbook alone. This claim, the irony is that one of the reasons for res judicata is judicial economy. Well, judicial economy is well served by what happened in the first case, because this case gets back to Judge Berryhill on the merits. There's summary judgment on the fact that Mr. Cudahy helped himself to well over $100,000 in interest and fees and consulting agreements that he had no right to.
Thank you, Mr. Boo. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments and the responses to the court's questions. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.